The Discover podcast covers the topics that you want to hear. Our autistic presenters bring together scientists, professionals, and experts by experience to discuss autism facts, theories, and personal stories. We include a broad range of views and informally chat about new or unfinished research, so don't take everything that you hear as fact. We look forward to including you in the conversation. Welcome to the Autistica Discover podcast, where we discuss autistic life, love, and everything in between. We want to create an inclusive world, so everyone's welcome to our podcast. Maybe you're autistic, or you think you might be. Maybe you know some autistic people, or maybe you just want to understand more. We're here to help you discover what life is like for autistic people.
My name's Laura James. I'm an author and a journalist, and I was diagnosed as autistic as an adult.
I'm Kat Hughes, I'm autistic, and I'm the Research and Grants Officer with Autistica.
Hi, I'm Colin, I'm autistic, and I'm a public health student, and I also work as a consultant for autism research. So the first interview that you're going to hear on the new season of the Discovercast, I could listen to all day, because she always speaks with such passion and always finds time to actually sit down and discuss these things, you know, either with me or other people in the community, despite doing so many projects and supervising lots of students and collaborating with so many partners. So this is Professor now, Jackie Rogers, who is one half of an awesome collaboration with Sarah Cassidy with the Mental Health Autism Project. So it was really nice to be able to sit down with Jackie Rogers and discuss all things anxiety. Such a huge topic, and there's lots of ongoing projects in this area, and some of which Jackie's very much leading the way.
We've been really focusing a lot of our efforts in terms of the intervention work and the theory work around a concept called intolerance of uncertainty, and we've been doing we've been doing work for about 8 years now on that. And, you know, looking at intolerance of uncertainty as one of the factors that might contribute to anxiety for autistic people and actually might maintain anxiety once anxiety's kind of kicked in to the level that it's impacting on somebody's life. That doesn't mean to say that we think it explains everything, because of course it doesn't, but I think it's a pretty major player.
And intolerance of uncertainty might be a phrase that's quite new to a lot of people. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about what it is, first of all. And actually, it's not something that's a very autism-specific thing, but actually the autism research community is really kind of leading the way almost.
Yeah, so the term it's quite an old-fashioned term in some ways, and that I think probably is a consequence of the fact that it was first developed in 1993, in Canada by a group who were working with adults who were experiencing generalized anxiety disorder, and which is kind of characterized by excessive rates of worry. So it's not an autism specific term at all, and there was a huge body of work that's been done with general population adults looking at intolerance of uncertainty. And I first came across it as a term when I was examining somebody's PhD thesis. So they hadn't done anything on autism, but I was asked to be their examiner. And it was the first time I'd heard of this term, because I've always, worked in autism. And it had never been used in autism before. And I was kind of reading a description of what it means. And essentially, if somebody has high levels of intolerance of uncertainty, then they hold beliefs that uncertain situations are upsetting, anxiety provoking, to be avoided, and they find it difficult to manage uncertain situations. And not just uncertain situations that might have a kind of negative outcome. And that was a really important thing for me. So, of course, if if you were waiting for the results of, you know, some medical tests from your GP, there's a potential that there might be bad news. And so nobody will like that uncertain situation. It's an uncomfortable situation to be in, and you would want it resolved and sorted out as soon as possible. But people who have high levels of intolerance of uncertainty kind of generally feel uncomfortable in uncertain situations, even if there's not potentially a negative outcome, even if it's a kind of neutral outcome, or even sometimes a positive one. So, you know, what's going to be in the gift that you've wrapped up for me? And I can't, you know. So, and that was really interesting when I kind of thought about that. And then I was thinking about this idea in relation to autistic people that I've worked with and that I know. And I could really recognise it as something that was a characteristic, that something they struggled with. And so talk to some autistic people and say, does this make sense to you? And yes was the answer to that. Yeah, this makes sense. So that then led to us doing some really preliminary work with children initially, to see whether intolerance of uncertainty was something that was recognisable to autistic children and to their families, and seemed to be related to the anxiety that people were experiencing. And the short answer to that was, yes, it was. And so that then led to a whole kind of proliferation of work around, okay, let's see what role intolerance of uncertainty has in anxiety in autism. But actually, there's emerging evidence that it's implicated in eating disorders, in social anxiety and OCD, and, you know, so it's what's known as a transdiagnostic mechanism. In other words, it kind of, you know, it's implicated across a range of experiences. And of course, what we know from work with autistic people is that often autistic people will be experiencing a range of mental health difficulties simultaneously, and often that then leads to concerns about, well, where do I start to support this person? Do I give them an intervention for their worries? Do I give them an intervention for their anxiety around social situations, or you know, their concerns about panic? Or, you know, where do you start with a person who's experiencing lots of challenges in that way? And this idea that intolerance of uncertainty might feed into all of them made us think, well, maybe we should intervene there. And if we intervene there, then maybe it'll have a knock-on effect across all these different range of difficulties. So we've started over the past few years developing interventions to try and that are designed for and with autistic people, to try and help them to manage uncertain situations a little bit better, in the hope then that that will help to reduce some of the anxiety that they're experiencing.
It's really interesting, a lot to unpick as well. Yeah. That I hadn't thought about the intolerance of uncertainty also being things that you may be very positive, and especially when you're talking about opening gifts, and that can quite often be a really awkward thing. I can remember always dreading it, and I always try and convince people, like, Christmas, we'll just go out and have a social, you know, event instead, rather than all the gift thing, partly because it's very wasteful, and there's only so much it can cram into a house, it's creaking at the seams. But also, I can remember there's lots of things I still have nightmares about things that happened as a child, but one of the things is always the, like, I'm a very grateful person, I always thank people, I love the puzzled faces in London when you thank people for things that apparently isn't the done thing, but I don't care, it makes people's day, it's nice to have a smile. But I can remember just the pressure of, you know, when you have a family gathered around and you're opening gifts, of having to react the right way straight away and be thankful. I'm always appreciative of things that they get, but that used to always heighten my anxiety. Yeah. One of the things that speaks to me as well with the work that you do is I always think you do the most collaborating of anyone I know, and that you sort of, you know, you're working with early career researchers, and you know, you found out about intolerance and certainly helping somebody with their PhD and as a supervisor, and you have the Northeast Autism Research Group, then you have the collaboration with Mental Health Autism, in all of the other work you're doing, and you collaborate meaningfully with the community in all of the projects you do. So, you know, obviously that's you're really leading an example of that, and there must be a real motivation behind it.
Well, I mean, that's really kind of you, Colin. Thank you. I just can't imagine doing it on my own, I suppose, is the simple answer to it. And I really enjoy bouncing ideas off people, and I do learn a lot from everybody that I collaborate with, you know, whether they are early career researchers, PhD students, autistic people. I think I guess it's if we work together, we'll do a better job, is basically the assumption. And it's great to have a thriving autism research community. You know, it's exciting. It makes coming to work exciting. And, you know, that's got to be a good thing when you've got, you know, when you kind of have to come. It's great to sort of, you know, have that community around you to work with and learn from.
And it is sort of setting an example for other areas of research. I can always remember, so when you talk about schools and teachers, it's kind of, it's more often you use the phrase that if you get it right for the children with autism in the classroom, that you tend to improve things for all of the other students. And I suppose that's sort of quite evident in the work in Ontario, and certainly that actually has wider implications for the general population. And actually, you know, that example of community participation and involvement and partnership working, it's actually just really, it's quite energising. I think the other thing that I noticed is that you're one of, I think, only one of the two northern people who volunteered to participate in the Charles Charland Grant, that Autistica had, which was very much bringing autistic people in as researchers who might have had a research idea but didn't really have any experience of doing research or hadn't necessarily been to university. And do you think it's really important to sort of bring new people into research and autism research and sort of nurture that talent as well?
I think it's absolutely critical, and I think it's particularly critical that we find mechanisms to support autistic people to become autism researchers, because we need to learn together, you know. And I think the Charles Charland scheme was a really great initiative, you know, to really try and enable true co-production of research. And, you know, I think it's the way forward. It's what we should be doing, you know. And so any opportunity to support an endeavour like that, I'd be absolutely, you know, very enthusiastic about it. I just don't see how we can progress without those sorts of initiatives. And we need to be researching the topics that are meaningful for the people that we're working with too. And, you know, we can only learn about that by asking.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. And again, we hope we'll be able to get you back again soon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for asking me, and very happy to talk again. Yeah.
I visited Queen's Mill School in London to chat to Freddie, the principal, about all of the work that he's been doing to reduce anxiety for students and help them better deal with uncertainty. So have a listen to some of the tips and tricks that he has.
My name's Freddie Adu. I'm the head teacher here at Queen's Mill School. We are a 3 to 19 special school for children with autism. So all children who attend have a diagnosis and also have an education, health and care plan. We also have a small post-19 unit for young people who are 19 to 25, who also have a education, health and care plan. And also attached to the school, we have three resource bases, which are located in two secondary schools and one primary school. So quite a diverse range of provision for children that attend.
So I'm here to talk to you about uncertainty and how students manage uncertainty and how you can help them with that. So the first thing I was wondering is, what types of uncertainty do you see causing issues for the students that you're working with?
I think the most fundamental uncertainty is, firstly, I think it's certainly to do with routine. So where there are breaks in routine, Most young people have difficulty with that. We know that from the very beginning. So we work to address that very early on in the children's time with us. So, for example, in early years, whilst we're getting children used to having a predictable schedule with a first, then, and next board and visuals to show them what they're doing now and what's happening next, we also like to keep an element of mystery where we can. So children get to understand that there's an activity that's coming up that I don't know what it is. I don't know what's going to happen. So we call it something like different, for example, so that the children don't have too many preconceived expectations of what that might be. And so it introduces them to change. Because we know that their flexibility around that is going to be so important to their well-being and their sort of comfort in and around the building, their social relationships, their flexibility with learning in so many aspects of their lives. The other key uncertainty that many children have is with people and expectations. So one of the first things we notice is that a lot of the children, in terms of their social relationships, they gravitate towards the adults. So adults, most of the adults at Queen's Mill are well-trained in autism, have it well-experienced. They're familiar with all of our resources and our approaches. And the children feel safe with the adults. They know that if they can't communicate or if they're confused or if they need help, they look to the adult and they know what to expect. And they're quite aware of each other. Mm. So even though you've got some children who have been together a long time in terms of being the same class, or even children who are verbal and can communicate, they don't really understand the rules of play very well or social engagement, and they find each other unpredictable.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, our playgrounds are quite an interesting places. You know, you've got little islands of individuals dotted all over the playground, unlike, say, a mainstream playground, where children generally tend to be comfortable in their own space or gravitate towards an adult. We try to facilitate that through structured sessions in terms of, you know, teaching children social learning, turn-taking, predicting whose turn is it next for an activity, structuring interaction in terms of verbal communication between them, understanding that learning can happen and can be enjoyable in a group. Mm-hmm. But we know that that's not children's intrinsic preference, so it's something we work with to prepare them for the life outside and beyond Queen's Mill. Another key uncertainty the children face is the physical environment. Mm-hmm. So we know when children first arrive at the school, it needs to be a physical environment that's conducive, that's to them remaining calm, that they're not overly stimulated by visuals, by noise, by smells, by close proximity of people. So the physical environment is we're lucky we've got purpose-built facilities for children with autism. So acoustically, there's facility to make sure the noise doesn't travel from one part of the school to another. Colours are muted so that it's not overpowering, overstimulating for children. Staff conduct themselves in a low arousal manner, so even when there is some distress or there is something that could be quite arousing, staff remain calm. Mm-hmm. Low voices, use visuals where they can. Just generally be very sensitive to the fact that, if their behavior is arousing, it escalates matters rather than de-escalating them.
Brilliant. And you were saying that there's quite a range in ages of students who are here. So do you find that there's different types of uncertainty that impact on students at different stages of their...
Most definitely. So in early years, we have lots of children who are coming to us... sometimes from home directly because they haven't appropriate placement hasn't been found, or they've gone to nursery and hasn't worked out, or they've gone into year one or year two of a mainstream primary school, and again for similar reasons, the environment hasn't been conducive. They haven't developed in accordance with mainstream expectations, and therefore, they're left behind in terms of their social and academic development. And so quite often when children arrive to us, they've experienced failure. And often, sadly, with some, they've experienced, I think trauma is a strong word, but they've found ways of coping with real stress. So it may be some very significant self-stimulatory behaviours as a coping mechanism. It may be some self-injurious behaviours. It may be, the fight or flight. It may be a range of things which are coping mechanisms for uncertainty, anxiety, and stress. We classify all of that under what we call emotional regulation under the CERTS methodology. CERTS stands for social communication, emotional regulation, and transactional supports. So it's a framework that underpins most of the resources that we use to support children, but also it determines the targets that we set in two domains: the children's social communication first and foremost. So how they're going to communicate with each other and with adults and with the world around them. So for some children that's verbal language. Some of them it's symbols. Some of them might be via an iPad. Some of this is with sign, with Makaton sign or sign along. And then the other key domain is the emotional regulation. So when they are feeling stressed, do they have ability to self-regulate, to remain calm, to find ways of expressing that stress in what the world will call a socially appropriate manner, or are they able to seek help? Mm-hmm. But we do teach them that their stress is going to happen. We recognize it's going to be more frequent because of their autism, but there are coping mechanisms. There are ways in which we can ameliorate that stress quite quickly and quite easily if they work with us. Mm-hmm. But it's an important part of our teaching. So in terms of our assessment of children's progress, 50% of our assessment is traditionally academic in terms of national curriculum subjects. The other 50% of the progress that we track is the children's autism. In other words, their social communication and their emotional regulation. Very, very important for us to make sure children progress in both domains.
Yeah. And then for the older students, what issues would you...
So with the older students, facing? I mean, puberty, adolescence, big transition into the next placement, secondary transfer, or transfer from secondary into post-19. All of that is quite significant. We have to prepare well in advance. The bodily changes are a really challenging time very often for children as they get into the secondary phase. So as some children, in terms of the hormones, so we see some sexualized behaviors from some who just don't know how to adapt to their growing and evolving body. So some children are very anxious about getting older, about growing a beard or their the voice breaking, or as I said, that their testosterone and all that sort of sexual energy with girls, obviously with their menstruation, with their sort of emotional volatility. So we do notice that in the secondary phase, we say this a lot of parents, there may well just be a crisis period for a few months where we work very closely with them in terms of what's happening at home and what they are doing in terms of managing that young person's adjustment to the uncertainty of their body and the uncertainty of their emotions and their moods, as well as what we're doing here at school in terms of how we are managing those adaptations that they have to make to their bodies as they grow up. And that usually takes the form of reduced demands. It takes the form of our personal, PSHE curriculum. We know that it's really quite a significant period, and we prepare quite well for it in terms of things having proper sensory supports available, so that young people can simply, go into an environment, maybe a sensory circuit or good outside space where where when it's all becoming too much, they can just, you know, be on their own and experience the sort of the physical environment to take away the stress that they're feeling inside their bodies or in their minds, without demands being placed on them.
And would you have any sort of tips then for either parents? I know I was going to ask you about parents, but also for autistic people ourselves, that we might use in terms of managing our own uncertainty, or the parents might use to work with their kids?
I mean, beginning with parents, I think first and foremost, there is visual supports that are absolutely crucial. I mean, there are we know from what parents tell us, from other autistic people tell us, from our own research, that oft times when people are feeling more anxious and more stressed, their language fails, and their typical sort of social reciprocation, their typical sort of mood and their way of sort of normally responding can fail or can change under stress, and so their self-symmetry behaviors might increase. One of the first things we say to parents and to colleagues, you know, is that, you know, allow that stimming to take place. It is a coping mechanism. There are sometimes instances where some children have a pattern of self-injurious behavior. If it's typical and it's not escalating, our experience has told us that don't interfere with that process, because, you know, it is a coping mechanism that's entrenched and fairly deep-seated. At times when it's escalating and it's becoming a new pattern, as it's showing, where there's clear harm being done and where we're worried about, then we intervene at those times. But certainly, in terms of our sort of general approach during the times where uncertainty has caused stress and this mood leading to a meltdown, that we are giving space, we're offering visual supports. We're allowing some of those self-stimulatory behaviors because it's necessary. We try and distract and motivate with things we know interest the relevant individual. But above all, you know, it's very sympathetic, because, you know, time is needed, and you know, as far as possible, you know, we adjust our demands significantly. Mm-hmm. And we don't blame them. We don't take a view that they know better and they should be doing better, or that these are the rules and, you know, you're break. You know, we recognize that there is a stressor in the environment. It might be change. It might be uncertainty. It might be, you know, trauma from the past, which is you know, inducing these behaviors. So we do a lot of our work is managing, you know, say, the children's emotional regulation and stress. And as far as possible, you know, we try and anticipate it by recognizing where anxiety is going to come. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I suppose, people, you know, on the spectrum themselves, I would say very often, you know, engaging with your body physically is going to help some of the sort of the trauma and the sort of the little ritual that your mind is stuck in. If you can come out of the sort of the loop that your mind is in, then very often that's the beginning of a release of the anxiety. And some of the anxiety, you know, we recognize where it's coming from. It's, as I say, it's anticipation of stress and pain or a situation being massively uncomfortable. It may well be, you know, just a repeated pattern in terms of, you know, the physical environment, where, you know, obviously there's unexpected noises. There are people who are not low aroused in their behaviour. There is obviously just overstimulus in the environment. But then there is also you know, a degree of trauma where some children, you know, they are revisiting the past, and something in the environment has triggered that, and they are replaying something that's happened to them that's caused them some distress. And we don't necessarily know what that is. We don't know the answer, but, you know, we recognize that there isn't necessarily an immediate trigger in the immediate environment. Yeah. So we have to really observe our students very, very carefully.
I met with Tom Manning and Georgia Harper. Tom is an actor who works in a university in Georgia, works with Autistica and our policy team. And we had a chat about uncertainty and how they both cope with it on a daily basis.
I have a really bad habit of essentially jumping from, like, I don't know what's going to happen, to literally the worst possible thing is going to happen. And it's going to be a disaster. Millions dead, you know. I think, particularly, obviously, being autistic, things that might seem small to other people can be a massive problem for me, which might not necessarily get recognised. So I kind of spiral into, you know, what if I have a meltdown at this big event, which never happens. Like, these days it's quite rare that I will actually have a massive public meltdown, but I spend a lot of time worrying about it.
yeah, that's really true. That's true for me as well, because you think everything's going great, and then something will come along and go, oh, why did you think that was going to happen? That's not going to happen. And then it's like if somebody's pulling a rug from underneath you, and it's not... I mean, you could say it falls into this idea of, okay, we're about to die or something like that. But that isn't the case. It's not death that we're afraid of. It's the actual idea of the worst thing happening,
yeah,
like you
exactly.
said.
Yeah, exactly. That's really well put.
Do you ever get the situation where you're certain about a thing, but because your certainty occasionally gets you into trouble, you have to be uncertain about that certain thing, because that makes you understanding the situation and more open to things changing better for later. Do you ever get that?
I guess there are times where I will kind of establish my own rules around something.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for me, if I get an invitation and a party starts at 7, like, that for me, I will be there, 10 to 7. I will be outside. But actually, I kind of picked up, again, mostly through uni and things like that, that you're not supposed to be exactly on time for reasons unknown to anyone. So I kind of work that in, and I kind of just mentally read it as, like, okay, 7:30. It will be 7:30. And, you know, and it's just kind of, yeah, having to...
Yeah.
But that's something we have to learn manually almost.
Yeah, yeah. I actually have a trick for this, which is you can always turn up at the time that the party says is going to begin if you bring food.
That's
if you bring
good.
Cake or mac and cheese, like a pasta dish or something, of course you're arriving early, then, because you have to have this food hot for everybody else.
And the bonus is you then get mac and cheese.
Yes! It's a double win. That's the way I've figured it out, which is I can definitely arrive on time, and it feels great to arrive at the time that the party says it's going to start. But if I arrive with something else, then it means I'm there for a reason, I'm there for a purpose, and also everybody's grateful that you've brought something that everybody can nosh on.
You've already kind of mentioned a huge amount of strategies that you kind of have to employ to deal with uncertainty, whereas I think non-autistic people seem like they just go about their day, which is a bizarre concept to me, without having to employ all those strategies all of the time.
Yeah.
So can you think of ways, I suppose, that uncertainty has had an impact on your life?
I mean, for me, it's quite like... It tends to be quite sort of small things. Like when I was thinking about this earlier, I'm sort of thinking, if I go out to eat a particular place, I will pretty much always have the same thing or one of the same few things. And that's not something I really think about of, like, I have, it's just habit. But also, you know, we've talked about this already, but sort of cliched as it sounds, unexpected changes can have a massive impact, because it's upsetting in itself, but also, until I've got to figure out what my new plan is, because it's kind of anarchy otherwise. Terrible anarchy where bad things might happen, but it's difficult to kind of put that thought process in place and think clearly about what you're doing next when you're upset. So it kind of spirals from there often. And I guess, like, this kind of comes back to what we were saying about parties and stuff. Like, I always worry about kind of being sort of trapped in a sort of overloaded environment. So, you know, if I'm at a party and I can't get home, or, you know, which will mean I tend to just not go. But actually, if I do go to these things and I'm worrying about what if I have a meltdown, it's that worry that is more likely to make me panic than the thing itself, which is frustrating, but there we are.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've created the strategies and everything to survive in this world, because... the human brain is a problem-solving machine. That's what it does. I mean, people get post-traumatic stress disorder because their brains are trying to solve a problem of the violent traumatic event that they went through, even though that violent traumatic event is no longer occurring. Their brain is still trying to adapt. And we adapt just like everybody else. We're trying to figure out how to be involved. And sure, it may be more cognitive than most people. My friend, when we was talking about comparing my brain to her neurotypical brain, she said, wow, you think in straight lines and squares and they all fit together and it's great and they all kind of line up brilliantly and beautifully, while her brain thinks in squiggly lines and it can go anywhere and go into anything and it'll be completely fine wherever it goes because it's a squiggly line. It doesn't need to be linear. It doesn't need to be focused in anything. And then I said, well, actually, you might have ADHD. But how much do you guys ever feel sure about what you're saying actually out of your mouth? How regularly are you going, right, this is the right thing to say right now, and then you say it and it lands, like people go, oh, I didn't think of that, or they laugh or they emote in some shape, way or form, and you go, yes, I nailed it, because you were certain about that thing. My life is filled with certainty because I've figured out all of the ways and all of the things that can be certain in that moment. The only times I get nervous is when people go into a proposition and go like, well, now we're going to talk about how much Carl's feelings are affected by our actions. And I'm like, ooh, I'm not sure about this, because I've never spoken about Carl's feelings before, and Carl's feelings might be interceding into other political backgrounds that I'm not really 100% aware of. So strap in, I guess. It's like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the work environment, because that's actually that was a thing that happened at work, is continuously evolving and adapting to the environment of the people who are working there. I mean, I work in operations for a drama school, and that means my whole entire job is reactionary, as in, we didn't realize we needed three tables in this room, but now we do, so let's go get them. And I described to my boss how sometimes when people go, ooh, we forgot to do this thing, we need to do this now, Tom, go do this, it's like somebody has just clapped right in my face and gone, do this now. And it's really shocking to me and everything. And my boss legitimately went, but you always look like you're so like confident and so capable and so like ready to go. And I went, yeah, that's because I have to. Because as soon as I look panicked, or as soon as I look like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do, everybody else is going to be unsure about what they're doing about the autistic guy who doesn't know what they're going to do. It's a vicious like paradigm of you have to be sure even when you're unsure around the people who are apparently sure about most things most of the time, because as soon as you're unsure, they're unsure about how to be sure about you. It's a whole thing. I mean, what are your thoughts?
So I work for Autistica. I work in policy. And as you will all know, nothing in politics is even remotely certain. There might be a different government when this comes out. I genuinely have no idea. So that's been a bit of a challenge. I love what I do, but I think it took me a little while, actually. I've been here for about a year. And it took me a little while, actually, to recognise, like, ah, actually, this is a challenge. Actually, tie it in. It's all uncertainty. Seems so obvious when you know. But yeah, I seem to, again, it's kind of a lot of what we do. I mean, not necessarily the entire job, but a lot of what we do is kind of reacting to, you know, if the Department of Health are doing something, if the NHS are doing something, we now need to change all of our timings around that.
Yeah.
If the BBC turn up and say we want to talk about eating disorders, we're going to like move the entire world to our eating disorders briefing comes out for them, because that's what's going to make the most impact. But yeah, it can be quite fun trying to keep track of all of that.
that's a nice way to look at it. Yeah. Fun indeed.
Fun quote. Well, I'm making air quotes with my hands and you can't see it.
That's actually really good advice, which is if you're ever feeling panicked about a situation, if you're unsure about the new thing that you have to do that you've never done before and you're afraid you're going to mess it up or do it wrong and everything, the best advice I ever got in my life has been, if you want to be good at something, learn to enjoy it. If you want to be good at this thing that you've never done before, if you want to be good at fixing a car, if you want to be good at talking politics with other people, learn the thing that makes you enjoy it, and then that's your motivator for everything else. So that's your surety, in fact, because you've found the thing that you've gone, I enjoy that bit, so I'm going to do that again and again every time I feel uncomfortable. And that's your sure thing. That's your rock that you can build your church upon. Mm-hmm. So a great way I've been putting it recently for how agreeable people with autism can be, because we're so used to being sure and then told, no, we're not sure. So then we have to take the lead off other people's surety. Is if I walk into a room of new people and I go, hi, I'm Tom. And they go, no, your name's Chris. I'm going to go, well, I guess I'm Chris now. Because we are so used to taking, in a way, the sure lead from other people, because other people are defining what is sure in our world more than ourselves. We are used to being sure about things and then realizing that that thing was never there. So we have to be sure about the perception that other people have of this sure thing so that we can continue life in the idea of, well, you're definitely going to do this right because Sam and Chris and Martha both agree that this is the right thing to do.
I am comically bad at decision making. And I have like the simplest thing, like, you know, the kind of, like everyone kind of has this, but you know, the kind of, where do you want to go? I don't mind. Where do you want to go? I don't mind. Where's easiest for you? Where's easiest for you? I'm like, I live in that loop, but like, I always feel like it's like they say they don't mind, but they do have a preference. They must have a preference.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all the advised one. And I think something I kind of learned, again, I guess it's sort of through work, like, actually, like, it's taken me a little while to be like, actually, I can probably make a decision on this. And then I'll go to others and go, does this sound sensible? And 9 times out of 10, they'll say, yes, it does. But kind of, yeah, it's such a weird, again, it's kind of a weird kind of learning to be an adult thing of like, yeah. Oh, I can't. But like Tom says, when you've kind of grown up in a kind of world where you perceive things a bit differently and everyone keeps telling you you're wrong, then no wonder that's a thing that a lot of autistic people have issues with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's another thing is social media and messenger apps and everything have made not having things defined way more of a regular thing in our lives than ever before. If you arranged to meet somebody somewhere and you went to that place and they weren't there, then they weren't coming. That was it, because that was, you had a phone call, that was it. Now, because of text, because of WhatsApp, because of DMing, everything can be like, yeah, let's say 6, and then it turns into 8 very easily. Everything's always up in the air. I remember recently coming from a show and then going and going to have dinner with 2 people who came to the show with me and meeting a 4th person at the restaurant that we're going to be going. We had not reserved anything. So we're going to this Tex-Mex place in Dalston. And then one of the people that I'm walking to the Tex-Mex place to goes, you know, I don't really feel Mexican tonight. I mean, can't we just go to like the diner and everything? And the other person went, you know what? I love the diner. Yeah, let's go to the diner instead. And then we continue walking without telling Jamie, who's waiting at the Tex-Mex, that we're going to this new place. And a part of me is going, okay, they know that we're going to meet Jamie. They know this. So I have to wait until they go and we're just going to message Jamie, right? And then they do. And they don't. And they don't. And they don't. And it's building bigger and bigger and bigger in my head to the point where I want to scream, hey guys, what about Jamie? He's still thinking we're going to have Tex-Mex. So instead I just go, yeah, okay, cool. Diner, yeah. Ooh, Jamie? Like, I have to put it like that. Because if I go, guys, what about Jamie? Too much? Too sure. So instead, I have to be as unsure as everybody else. I have to be up in the air as everybody else. So when I go, oh, hey, what about Jamie? They go, oh, yeah, Jamie. Yeah, of course. Great. And then they text. And then we all go to the diner and have great fried chicken. But at the same time, there was a moment in time where Jamie had no idea what was going on. I had no idea what was going on. The only two people who knew what were going on were the two people who went, Tex-Mex, don't know. That was it.
In my head, Jamie remains in this Tex-Mex to this day. Jamie, if you're listening, they're not coming. I'm really sorry.
The food's good.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry, he joined us.
Okay, that's good.
It was great. Don't worry. It's okay. We all had fried chicken and waffles. It was fine. Yeah, yeah.
Like, growing up, I was always, she gets good grades, what's the problem? I was diagnosed, but nothing's ever done about it, because grades. And I think I spent a lot of time thinking that my difficulties, like, weren't bad enough to count. Quote marks again, you can't see it, weren't bad enough to count, or that they were, like, just part of my autism.
I think that's fascinating, actually, like, though, that they went, like, oh, we don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
Because academically, yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah,
wait, what?
Yeah, no, that's a whole other podcast. But
it really is.
Oh, no, I said that in front of the podcast presenter, and now I have to come back.
Write it down.
But, like, I think... towards the end of uni, because obviously you get into different contexts, living independently and so on, I kind of sought support. It wasn't specifically around uncertainty, it was more for kind of the social side of things. But the main thing I kind of remember learning from that is at one point someone actually told me, like, you know, uncertainty doesn't mean something bad's going to happen. And, like, it's obvious now, it's kind of mind-blowing. It's like, what? Seriously? Like, and I kind of come back to that. I mean, like, oh, right, it actually doesn't mean that, like, the worst case scenario is going back to happen. And more recently, I ended up going to a DP, something slightly different. To cut a very long story short, my anxiety goes through the roof in the summer months for reasons known to absolutely nobody. And it's kind of another issue, but last year, something I found particularly difficult was the fact there was just no end point. The forecast went for 14 days and the heat wave was more than that. And there was no interest. Yeah. I don't like, oh. And actually, like, weirdly, I found the snow last year really difficult as well, because uncertainty, because trains. I was commuting into London at that point. Mm. And then now I'm in London and it snowed the winter. That was fine. But anyway, so I went to a GP around that. IAPT, which is Improved Access to Psychological Therapies, basically the sort of frontline kind of mental health people, they're going to see me at the end of October, which is not how the seasons work in this hemisphere. So if anyone has a TARDIS I can borrow. But anyway, so I'm reading up at the moment on kind of anxiety phobia stuff. And in terms of bringing this back to uncertainty, some things I found is, like, there was a thing, one of the kind of thinking traps. I know I'm probably, like, shouldn't say this as an autistic person, but I've actually had a really good experience with, like, CBT type techniques. And,
me too.
Yeah, and, like, recognizing the kind of thinking traps I'm falling into and challenging that. And one that I hadn't come across before was scanning. And it's essentially like, the memes you get that are like, studies show that if you're scared of spiders, you're more likely to see one. There's actually truth in this, because you will immediately, for instance, you will go into a new room and it will immediately scan for the thing you're scared of, which means you're more likely to see it and you're more likely to have false alarms.
Yeah.
And something else that I found is that a lot of my worries, in terms of the weather stuff, a lot of my worries are, well, I can cope now, but it's only May. It's only, what about when it gets worse? It's continually going to get worse. And like, even, and then it's like, but that kind of is like, but then it might be fine. And it's fine now, and what am I doing? So I think actually even just keeping a record and looking for support for this other stuff, so much of it boils back down to uncertainty. And it's like, it's really weird when you think about it. It's like, oh, it all ties into this. And yeah.
Is there anything positive that we can take from uncertainty and how we feel about uncertainty? The one thing that I think is, I know for myself, when it comes to a genuine emergency, I am the absolute best.
Oh my goodness, yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah, we are the go-to people when stuff is going down. Absolutely, because we had a medical emergency at where I work recently, and the first aider needed to see this person and clarify what they're dealing with, and then call paramedics to come in and sort them out and stuff. And it was all done with this idea of, oh my goodness, what are we going to do now? It was like, we're not sure. And I was like, okay, I got this. First thing we're going to do is we're going to call the paramedics and we're going to tell them exactly the issues that this person is dealing with. Then we're going to be ready for this ambulance to arrive at our building. So we're going to make a clear path from the ambulance to the individual in need. And we're all going to have radio so we can keep in contact so that when the ambulance arrives, we know it's arrived and it's going to be with the subject who is currently dealing with the thing, to make sure that they know that that person is going to be cared for as soon as possible. And all of these things just came out of my mouth because I'm so used to dealing with things of being, oh my goodness, it's the worst situation. What are we going to do? Because it's way bigger in our brains than it is usually, that when the actual big thing occurs, we nail it so goodness well. It's great. Yeah.
This is the moment I've been training for all these years.
I'm slightly worried now. I can't think of any major emergencies that have happened to me. So maybe one's going to come and I'm going to have to prove my worth.
I'd say try to keep it that way.
When I was in sixth form, I volunteered for a little while with St. John Ambulance, which is first aiders.
Yeah.
And luckily, I didn't actually ever have to deal with anything major. But I guess, yeah, I can see where that kind of process comes from. I mean, I will say for me, and this maybe says a lot about my weirdly skewed priorities, but I talked a bit about the weather earlier, and I always have an umbrella in my bag that I can lend to people. Like, I don't care if it's July. I'm an optimist. I have it. And, like, and all the stuff that's, like, you know when there's, like, when the heatwave advice starts coming out, I'm like, I know this. Why are you telling me this? I know it. I have it down. I have it down. I'm not sure if I'm good at like major emergencies, but I'm good at rain. I have an umbrella.
I will say another positive thing about being uncertain, which is you're so used to living in an environment of uncertainty and finding that certain thing that you are way more open to new situations than other people would be. Other people don't want to try out new things because they're so used to their lives being okie dokie and then going into something that they have no idea how to do. They just go, well, I can't possibly do that. Why would I even try? But because we're continuously creating skill sets to be dealing with new parameters of life that we've never experienced before, that if we go, hey, I think I'm going to go to Florence this weekend, and then we go, Florence is a crazy city that is essentially all made from one material, so it all looks the same. You're walking down and all the buildings are the same height, and you continuously feel like you're walking in one place. Even though you're crossing the entire city, you feel like you're walking one place because everything's made from the same thing. So there's no certainty in that city at all until you come to the cathedral or till you come to the river or something like that. And I was fine, because the whole entire time I was listening to podcasts and I was going, okay, if I'm going to eat, I want to eat at this Italian restaurant that has already gotten these reviews. So I just need to head this way that Google Maps has told me. That's my certain thing. Yeah. So all of these things of people going like, ooh, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do this. We're great at doing the new thing. We're brilliant at it because we are continuously doing it.
I find it really interesting, actually, again, especially since kind of moving down to London. I find it really interesting that as someone that on paper does not deal with the tiniest bit of uncertainty very well, I find it really interesting how many kind of bigger things I will decide to spontaneously do. If I have a quiet weekend, I'll wake up and I'll think, I'm going to get the bus to Edgware. I know Edgware isn't quite as impressive as Florence, but like, but like, you know, I'm going to go tick off this new tube station. Or,
yeah.
And I think like, it's really weird that, and I think that's something I need to maybe do some more sort of pattern spotting in myself, but that there do seem to be certain times where I will be spontaneous or I will be flexible. And yeah, I don't know. I think that perhaps that's, you know, perhaps that's part of it. Something I will say is that like, you sometimes get this idea that anxiety is like inevitable in autistic people, or it's just a part of autism. And actually it doesn't, what that shows is it doesn't have to be. If we're in the right environment for us and we're supported properly and everything else, like, it's not something you have to accept.
If you're autistic, a family member, a researcher, or if you work with autistic people, you can join Discover. Discover is the UK's autism research network run by Autistica.
You'll get email updates on the latest research, and you'll hear about studies you can take part in. By working together and sharing knowledge, we can make real progress for autistic people. Join now at autistica.org.uk/joindiscover.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to hear more, and we'd love it if you'd leave us a review.
Discover is brought to you by Autistica, the UK's autism research charity.